Welcome to York Hospital Radio Meets, a podcast from York Hospital Radio.
York Hospital Radio.
Welcome to the latest edition of YHR Meets. I'm Steve Eccles.
And I'm Keith Lee.
Keith and I recently visited the North Yorkshire Moors Railway to talk to some of the key staff who maintain this award-winning heritage railway as one of England's finest. Having covered a huge amount of ground during the visit, we've split this podcast into two episodes. In this first episode, we explore the management aspect of this heritage railway with five key members of the team. In the second part, we take a deep dive via a site visit at Levisham into lineside management, and then an even deeper dive into the activities and projects being undertaken at the railway's motive power depot at Gromond. Before we introduce our guests, let's provide you with an overview of the North Yorkshire Moors Railway, the NYMR. The railway runs through the North York Moors National Park and was first opened in 1836 as the Whitby and Pickering Railway. It was conceived in 1831 by George Stephenson as a means of opening up trade routes inland from the then important seaport of Whitby. The British Rail route between Gromont and Rillington on the York to Scarborough line was closed in 1965 as part of the beaching cuts across the railway network.
In 1973, the 18-mile section between Gromont and Pickering was reopened by the North York Moors Historical Railway Trust Limited. It was a preserved line plus a tourist attraction which has been awarded several industry accolades. In 2007, the railway started to run regular services over the 6-mile or 9.7-kilometre section of the National Railway network along the Esk Valley line between Gromont and Whitby. In 2014, a second platform was opened at Whitby, which allowed the NYMR to run an enhanced service, which led to passenger numbers in the same year of nearly 350,000. Since 2020, the railway has operated over a total of 24 miles or 39 kilometres, managed as a charitable trust, with a mix of full-time staff, seasonal staff, complemented by around 1,000 volunteers.
There are stations at Pickering. The southern terminus of the line has been restored to its 1937 condition and is home to a carriage workshop, working turntable and a learning and visitors centre.
And then we have Levisham, a small countryside station set in the Newtondale Valley. The station is located nearly 2 miles or 3.2 kilometres from the village of Levisham, which it serves.
Newtondale Halt is a remote walker's request stop in Cropton Forest, where there are forest walks of varying lengths.
Goathland remains virtually unchanged since its construction in 1865 and has been restored to represent a North Eastern Railway country station post-World War I, circa about 1922.
Gromont has been restored to the British Railway style of around 1952, and the locomotive sheds are situated here, just south of the tunnel, through which trains run en route to Goathland and beyond. Time now to meet our first guest. Well, I'm joined now by the CEO of the North Yorkshire Moors Railway, Laura Strangeway. Laura, thank you very much for giving up your time to talk to us today for this podcast. Now, our listeners, like myself, who will have seen the Channel 5, the fantastic Channel 5 Fly on the Wall documentary series about the NYMR, will probably remember you as Laura from marketing, which I know is what you were at the time. So I'm rather guessing that you've been here at the railway for a little while and perhaps you've risen through the ranks, as it were.
Yeah, just a little bit. So I've been here just over 9 years and I came in as the head of marketing. I was then given the opportunity to have everything that made money under me. So that included the Pullman Diner, tea rooms, retail, alongside the marketing. I then acquired HR as well. And then by this point, I was kind of the deputy. So, yeah, then obviously Chris stood down and I became the CEO.
Now, I've got to ask you, I thought this Channel 5 series was absolutely, or the two Channel 5 series were absolutely brilliant. Was it a pretty accurate reflection of what was going on at the time? It was a fascinating watch.
They weren't necessarily staged. What I would say is TV likes drama. So everything that was a problem got heightened to create that you know, dramatic, you know, the railways come to the rescue. It was less so dramatic in real life. But yeah, it was good fun filming them. And it certainly drew attention to the sector and to the Mars. And you know, that's what we're here to do and to keep the wheels turning, as they say.
I must confess, we had a little catchphrase at home because the number of times Mark Addy was doing the commentary said, but there's a problem.
Because they like drama and they like the fix and the solution. And we lend ourselves quite well to that. It does come across our way. Perceived that there was a problem every day, which is less so the reality.
But I imagine that the profile raising from that series must have done the railway a lot of good.
Oh, absolutely. And I think just the challenges around running a heritage railway did come across on the positive side. I like to think of steam engines as old ladies, and they're very fickle and they get tired and they break, and you've got to nurture them, and that's what we try and do, and we try to keep them on the tracks, and it can be challenging at times.
We'll come back to those challenges in just a moment. What does the role of a CEO actually involve? For example, how many staff have you got here? How many volunteers do you manage?
So roughly just over 1,000 volunteers, and there's around 130 paid staff. That can be challenging in itself. So there's a lot of man management and just talking to keep everyone on the right track, you know, keep them travelling in the right direction, which is where we want to go.
Is your role, do you think, more about managing the people or managing the grand old ladies on the trains?
100% the people. That takes more time. I don't claim to be an engineer. We've got engineers to do that, and they do a really good job. We've just had our diesel gala. It was a huge success, and this is where the engineers shine during that period. They keep them old ladies moving. I should not keep referring to them as that, and they did a great job.
And just to give us a bit more context, we've talked about the number of staff and volunteers. What's the turnover of the business here? It must be huge.
It's around 10 million, quite a substantial amount. And that's a mix of, you know, obviously traffic income, secondary spend, grants, bequests, legacies. So there's a whole myriad of income streams. We even have a second business outside of the sheds that make lubricating pads. So there's lots of complexities at the Mars that keep that high level of income coming in.
And now that you are CEO here, does this feel like you've achieved a lifetime ambition to get this far?
No, not yet.
Not yet?
No, not yet. I'd like to leave here with it in a much more sustainable place. I'd like the money to be in a much more sustainable place. That would be my goal before, you know, leaving or moving on.
What do you see as the main purpose of a heritage railway in the 21st century? I mean, for many people, it's just a tourist attraction, but I'm guessing there's rather more to it than that.
Yeah, I think there is. I think it's all about nurturing history and bringing it to life. And I think we're quite early on in that journey. I think typically heritage railways have just been about moving people from X to Y. I think we're now going down a route which is much more about bringing the railway to life. What does it stand for? What's its history behind it? But like I said, we're very early on in that journey.
You talked a few minutes ago, Laura, about challenges of running a heritage railway, of which I guess there are plenty. But what do you think are the main challenges in 2025?
Money, 100%. It's the biggest thing that keeps me up at night. There's a lot of factors that played a part into where we are at this minute in time. Obviously, the fallout of COVID and restoring footfall to where it was. You've also got extortionate rising costs, the war in Ukraine and tendering for the coal on a worldwide sector. Coal substantially went up pre-COVID at roughly around £140 a tonne. At its peak, it went to about £540 a tonne. So what's naturally happened, I think it's fair to say across the sector, is incomes remain on par. It's not massively grown, it's held its own, but costs have risen exponentially and we haven't kept up with them. So we're now as a sector trying to find our way out of that. It is a very challenging time, a very stressful time.
And in terms of the coal itself, I mean, there are also issues about whether you're actually going to be allowed to burn coal, I think I'm right in saying, answer in years to come.
Yeah, and I think our approach to that is a mix. So you want to still retain that heritage feel of it. You want to be able to demonstrate, you know, this is how these great engines worked and what they stood for. So I think there's a piece for that almost within the right situation. Again, this comes back to the interpretation piece. Where we are making headway, we're converting Omaha, which is another engine, into oil conversion. Where we see it is you've got to have multiple options to play around with. So what Omaha will give us is the ability to run in hot weather without causing tinder fires, and that's a big game changer for us because we run through a triple SI, because we're surrounded by moorland. That is a real risk to us. Obviously, the last 4 or 5 weeks we've been running diesel engines because temperature arising, and it's going to continue that. Each summer is becoming longer, which is a challenge. It's a massive challenge for us, and that obviously impacts income as well.
I was actually just about to ask how people's habits have changed since COVID, both in terms of do people travel and do things in a leisurely way like they used to? Do they spend as much? And equally, if you are running diesels rather than steam, does that stop people coming?
Yes. So certainly the minute we run purely diesel engines, we see a drop off in income. It's really hard to manage that, because the Mars is typically positioned as a steam heritage railway. Actually, we're not. We're a heritage railway, and it shouldn't matter whether we're running steam or diesels. It's all about recreating history. However, cutting that across, and obviously where income is, it does impact. So there's a cultural shift change piece that needs to happen. Visitors, what do they expect? I think they expect more for their money and value for money. So it's more than just travelling and from A to B. It's about that experience, that added value. And again, that's quite new for us, which we're playing around with new events at the minute and see how the market reacts to that. Yeah, and some things will get right and some things will probably get wrong.
Because it's a lot more than just a train journey, isn't it? I mean, it's all the stations, all of which offer different things on this line, don't they?
And it's about opening up your attraction to new audiences, which is quite niche, especially in the demographic where we are. One of the challenging factors is many of the heritage railways have gone down the route of more events. Well, we're predominantly a holiday market area. So when you're trying to pull people out, say, for example, Whitby, or you're adding events on when people are on holiday, typically that doesn't work as well if you're drawing from your domestic local market. So again, there's lots of factors that play a part in this.
The ability to run the trains to Whitby must be an absolute godsend, I would imagine.
It comes with its pros and cons. So running on the main network resource adds a lot of complexities. One of the big challenges with that is, like a car has an MOT, an engine has an MOT. Running on the main network, that major MOT happens every 8 years as opposed to 10 years when you're running on the heritage railway. So obviously costs play a big part, because you've just eroded 2 years of your MOT, so to speak. It definitely has its pros. We're known for it. It pulls a huge amount, roughly about 65% travel to Whitby again. So it is a huge money spinner for us.
And I've got to say, for anybody who hasn't done that bit yet, it's a stunning journey. Well, the whole line is, of course, but the last bit going down by the River Esk under the viaduct, it's fantastic. We've talked about a lot of the challenges, Laura, but what do you see as the high points of your job? In other words, why are you doing it?
What I've found at the Mars is there's massive highs and massive lows. I think that's like any other business, though, to be fair. The King's Visit, you know, it was the 50th year of the MYMR. We were celebrating that we're a volunteer-led organisation. So to cap that up by the King's Visit with Flying Scotsman was just magical. I think it's a real achievement from where the railway's been, and it's gone, and it's still on its journey for the next 50 years. So couldn't run this place without the volunteers and our staff. You know, they do a really good job, and so incredibly proud.
Once again, to put all of this in context, how big a contribution to the local economy does the NYMR make?
A huge amount. Used to typically the number around 35 million, but you only have to see the winter period when we're not running trains that the market town's just exceptionally quiet. And that's a huge burden as well, in the fact that you're very acutely aware of any changes we make to our timetable has a knock-on impact to the local businesses. I think where I have to kind of put blinkers on is, you know, we need to get through this challenging period for the better and come out at the other side of it. So there is some difficult decision I'm having to make at the minute. Again, we weren't the first to do this in the sector, the heritage railway sector, but we have reduced our operating days from 7, you know, every day a week from opening, and we're flexing it down to 5. But again, that has an impact to the local businesses. But broadly speaking, that removed about $500,000 out of the operating costs. And when you're in survival mode, it were a necessity.
What do you see as the immediate and the longer term future of the NYMR? How is it going to continue to evolve?
Immediate, making sure we're financially sustainable and looking at new revenue streams and opening up new audiences and using the railway in a different way, or lots of different ways. So that's one thing that we're focused on at the minute. Long term, it would be great to have a sustainable business that is delivering on all these extra activities, that's more immersive, that's bringing the railway to life, whether that's through storytelling, interpretation, all that good stuff. And I think it's positioning the railway to be more than just a journey.
And following on from that, why do you think it's important in 2025 to have heritage railways? I mean, the country's got plenty, haven't it?
It's a huge benefit to the local economy, for one. Collectively, it's a staggering amount. But equally, I think it's about preserving a piece of history. And even I now, being here 9 years, when an engine pulls up into a station and you see it and you're immersed in that history, there is something magical about them. And I think to have a class of engine in traffic across the sector, whether that's a different railway, I don't think that matters. I think it works and it complements us as a sector. Yeah, that's something to be proud of as well.
How much contact does the NYMR have with other heritage railways?
Quite a lot. So we have the Heritage Railway Association. They hold 2 annual seminars or conferences a year. I've got board members that sit on there, so there's a huge crossover there. I mean, the Heritage Railway Association generally is very approachable. You can pick up the phone to their CEO and have a chat. So yeah, I think the sector is quite close-knit community in a supportive way. But yeah, very, very close.
So finally then, Laura, is there such a thing as a typical day for you? I mean, as a CEO, are you constantly in meetings? Do you get the chance to travel on your own railway? How does it work?
Lots of meetings, painfully too many meetings. I try and get out once a week, don't always succeed in that. That's always my goal. No, there's not one day the same. They're all a little bit crazy, if I'm totally honest, and you don't quite know what's going to happen that day. But it also adds variety to life, which is always good.
And this will be my final question. If I asked you for any particular highlights of your time as CEO, I'm guessing you're going to say the royal visit.
Yeah, and I think even things like the initiatives with Omaha, they're big game changers. Once that's out in traffic, that'll be another big highlight.
Laura Strangeway, CEO of the NYMR, thanks again for your time and thanks for allowing us to do the podcast on your railway.
No, thank you very much. Thank you.
Right, in the Spring Moors Line magazine to NYMR members, Steve Oates, Chief Executive of the Heritage Railway Association, expressed some views on understanding who your competitors are, what changes may be necessary in the type of events and experiences that you offer to ensure that tourists, families and enthusiasts come to your railway first. Who better to explain how the North Yorkshire Moors Railway is addressing his remarks than Charlotte Hawes, the railway's events and guest experience manager. Welcome to our podcast, and let's start with some background about yourself, how you came to be part of the railway's family, and some details regarding your role.
So, I'm approaching 20 years in the events industry now, having started straight out of university at the internationally renowned York Racecourse. From there, I moved into education, leading the events at York College across both further and higher education. After that, I enjoyed a small period of freelance work before taking a role in the tourism sector at Visit York. During my time there, I was fortunate enough to deliver some really high-profile events for the city. You may have heard of some of them, including York Ice Trail, Visit York Tourism Awards, and numerous Christmas light switch-ons. Now, one of my personal highlights was when York was a host city for the Rugby League World Cup. Now a mum of 2 young children, aged 1 and 3, with very little sleep, I returned to maternity leave ready for a new challenge. Now, the opportunity arose to join the North Yorkshire Moors Railway as the events and visitor experience manager, and I thought, you know what, why not? Why not step into something completely different? I've never worked with a moving venue before. You know, it was a new sector in Heritage Rail, something I'd never worked in before, and it definitely felt like the perfect next step. It's different, it keeps me very busy, but it's a really, really exciting. So we plan the programme event from the concept right through delivery.
What sort of people within the organisation do you have to liaise with to put all this together for events?
So I do work really closely with the operations department, operations manager. Obviously the marketing team, you know, I work really closely with Laura, our CEO, with the MPD, absolutely everybody. It's a real sort of team effort.
And who has the last word in terms of the events that actually take place?
Oh, that's a really tricky one. It depends on the type of events, really. And like I say, quite often, depending on whether, you know, there's a big cost involved and stuff like that, we obviously always have to really look into how it's going to benefit the visitors, but also the railway itself, you know. And we don't want to be doing things that are, you know, going to be a cost to the railways.
As far as the annual activity window, when does that start and when does it finish? What influence does things like bank holidays and school holidays have on what you do and when you do them?
Our events calendar is heavily shaped by the seasons, allowing us to create experiences that really resonate with our visitors throughout the year. So we love the school holidays. They're a great opportunity to introduce new family-friendly activities while continuing to run our much-loved heritage services for everybody to enjoy. This summer, we're excited to launch Pixies and Pirates, which ties in with the Pickering Pixie Trail at one end of our line and the upcoming Pirate Festival in Whitby at the other end of the line. We add on extra services for the Heartbeat Gotland event, giving visitors more flexibility and choice to travel the line and get involved in this summer. But we also align with national programmes such as Railway 200, ensuring we're sort of part of that wider celebration as well. And of course, we celebrate the festive season with our ever-popular Santa services, while the autumn brings a new thrilling edition of Mad Alice's Ghost Train around Halloween time. So we've got something pretty much all year round going on.
Now, in this article I referred to at the beginning from Steve Oates, he talks about things like demographics and economics and political landscape changes within the society that we live in today. I mean, have you found yourself having to adjust the type of events to make it more attractive for people to come here rather than other tourist attractions?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of competition out there, and understanding our audiences and tailoring events to suit them is central to what we do. Whether we're engaging families looking for memorable experiences or enthusiasts with a deep passion for heritage rail. Now, with rising running costs, we're having to obviously be more strategic than ever in how we plan, promote and deliver our events. So we're always carefully assessing the financial viability of each event, including how we market them and who we target. But to ensure that visitors receive real value for money, we've been adding a wide range of free activities to enhance the experience, such as History of the Line Talks, Meeting the Baby Dinosaurs and Summer Offers, which encourage passengers to travel the full line while enjoying inclusive activities at our station. And while fewer people today remember sort of the steam era firsthand, people still love to see the steam sort of chuffing along our line. And our goal is to sort of strike the right balance, creating events that evoke that nostalgia for longtime fans whilst offering something exciting and new for generations to enjoy.
Do you get much opportunity to sort of capitalise on TV and films where they want to film bits on railways?
Yeah, we receive a high number of inquiries for filming on the railway, and some of the major productions like Mission Impossible and Indiana Jones that have gone ahead have helped to create a real buzz and excitement for people visiting, especially once the films or the shows have been released. We're always exploring ways to maximise the impact of these opportunities. Last year, we launched our Lights, Camera, Traction film and TV trail, which highlights some of our most popular screen appearances filmed along the line. We also extend the experience into our station shops. For example, at Gotland Station, we offer a popular range of Harry Potter-themed merchandise.
Have you got what you would call a big seller?
Well, we're still hoping to announce another visiting locomotive to our events calendar, so look out for that one. We're partnering with a fantastic theatre production company to enhance our Santa Express services, which will promise an even more magical experience for families this festive season. So that's always a really, really good and exciting big seller for the railway. And we're also thrilled to be welcoming the Railway 200 Inspiration Train, which will offer visitors the chance to enjoy a special experience free of charge, obviously as part of the national celebrations of Railway 200.
In terms of your ticketing system and the way it's structured, how do you go about deciding the structure and the price, and what sort of incentives might there be, and can you use gift aid?
We've got a real varied ticketing offer at the railway. Our standard seasonal services allow passengers to enjoy unlimited hop-on, hop-off travel along the full length of our line for the entire day with just one ticket. We also have a donation fair and gift aid opt-in on top of that. And because of the generosity of our visitors, last year we received over £400,000 from gift aid donations. So thank you so much to everybody that opted in for that. It's a massive add and plus to the railway. For those that prefer shorter journeys, we also offer return on single tickets for travel between one or two stations. And we've just introduced discounts for advance bookings up to 30% off with our summer offer. And we've also extended our popular family ticket. So previously this allowed up to two children to travel free. It now accommodates much larger families for the summer period. Then for special events where there's significant costs involved in the stage, in the experience, we usually apply a more fixed pricing base on the event, depending on the event's scale and the capacity and the offering. And then we've got our galas, which typically run over sort of multiple days. So these would include your discounted multi-day ticket options.
In terms of all these events in this modern day when everyone's using their phone and the tablets and computers and social media, have you had to adapt in the way that you advertise?
Yeah, so our marketing approach is really varied. So we have a mix of digital and traditional media running throughout the year. We maintain general awareness campaigns online year round and do some print then during the summer. We work really close in partnership with Visit North Yorkshire, promote both the railway and the wider region. And then we're also doing campaigns on local bus sites too. So, keep an eye out for those. Our website receives really strong traffic. And according to sort of the post-visit service that we do, it remains one of our main sources for information about the railways. Our digital campaigns, we find that we really do carefully target the audiences and target to audiences with shared interests. And then we've obviously got our e-newsletter, which has a real healthy, active readership. We, for enthusiasts, we focus events like our galas. We place print ads in leading industry magazines, while we've got our organic social media content, including highlights and behind-the-scenes stories, which reaches wider audiences. We strive to make the most out of the budget and resources available to us. And talking with you today, while not advertising in a traditional sense, it does play a valuable role in raising awareness of our heritage railway and the charity behind it.
So if I were to ask you for a summary of what's coming up in the rest of the railway season, would you like to tell us what you've got on?
Yes, so we've got, as I mentioned, we've got our Pixies and Pirates through the summer. We then have our annual Steam Gala, which is taking place in September, a celebration for traditional steam-loving nostalgia seekers and families who remember stories of their granddad working on the railways or just simply share a deep love for steam locomotives. We've got, as I mentioned, new for 25, it's Mad Alice's Ghost Train, which is a completely new type of event for the railway. We are collaborating with the Bloody Tour of York for this and York Gin to put this event on. And we're aiming for the thrill seekers and those that are up for something a little bit different. We also have our much-loved Santa Express services, which remain a festive highlight for families and grandparents alike. And, a chance to meet Santa and enjoy a performance and have a rain ride. What else could be better? And then, of course, we've got our Pullman dining services with gin and whiskey tasting options available too.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. And I hope that you have great success with everything that happens. And then you'll start all over again.
We will indeed. And thank you very, very much for having us. It's been great chatting to you. And we hope that everybody comes and visits us at the railway for whatever that, that may be.
I'm joined now by Kerry Carruthers, who is the Head of Engagement here at the NYMR. So actually, let's start at the beginning. Head of Engagement, what does that mean, Kerry?
Well, thank you for obviously having a chat to me today. Head of Engagement really is about what our supporters' needs and wants. So a lot of work that we do is really kind of looking at you know, what opportunities that we can provide to them to have better experiences when they want to kind of come to the railway, or, you know, if they would like to donate and support us in different ways. And we're here really to be able to speak to them, find out, you know, what it is that they love about North Yorkshire Moors Railway and provide them with those opportunities back.
And I'm guessing that's for customers and for members as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, we've got a real strong member loyalty base, which is absolutely fantastic. Then we've got our supporters that will donate to different campaigns that we've done over the years. So we're always really open to having a chat with people, because we love to know what they really like and what we could do more of and how we can say thank you, because that's a big part of what we do. You know, we are here to be able to raise funds to do things that maybe our booking office wouldn't be able to do through the kind of normal visitor fares. And what I'd like to think is that we keep kind of giving people different opportunities to say, how can you get involved? How can you share your ideas? How can you help us? And it's not just monetary either. So, you know, we're always here to chat to people.
For the purposes of the podcast today, we're probably going to focus a little bit more on the fundraising side of the role. And I just wonder, because obviously the NYMR is a very large organisation, as we've already established from Laura, in general terms, how much money do you need to raise every year to actually keep functioning, in addition to ticket prices and things like that?
Well, that's a big question, because I'm sure, as everyone can imagine, it's a big railway and there are a lot of different things that always need to be maintained or restored. So everything from bridges to track to new investments in infrastructure. And then we've got our locomotive restorations. We basically look at each of these as a different opportunity for people to engage with us. So, for example, with Green Knight, we're looking to raise over £200,000 this year in the Railway 200 year. But that's the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of what we need. And we're always going to keep coming up with different ways that people can support us.
And indeed, I was just about to ask you, what are the main ways in which you do raise money? Are there traditional ways that you do? Are you always open to new ways of fundraising?
Always open to new ways, because times change, people's habits change, people want to get involved in different ways. So, for example, with our Green Knight campaign, this is a first for us in terms of we're basically creating an opportunity for people to sponsor one of the boiler stays or have their name on one of the running boards. And, you know, this is a bit of a trial for us. We're really pleased at the support that we've had already from people. It's raised just over £15,500. Obviously, a long way to go. But if anybody's got ideas in terms of how they could support us, could they do a fundraising appeal and help us contribute to it? You know, we're always open to that.
Because the numbers here are always very large, aren't they? You never launch a small fundraising campaign because all the projects are huge.
They are. And I think this is the one thing that I can say since joining the organisation, that you just don't appreciate how big and how complex some of these restorations can be. It's never going to be small. You know, look at the size of a steam locomotive. They're massive. Look how many wheels and tyres that they're going to need, or, you know, the cost of a boiler. It's so different scale-wise. So it's always going to be big amounts. But, you know, the generosity through our donors and supporters has just been fantastic over the years. So we really hope that we can keep saying thank you, keep encouraging people to keep supporting us as time goes by.
You've mentioned Green Knight, which is in itself a massive project, which for most railways would probably be enough. But here you're also trying to restore and bring back to life Dame Vera Lynn, so to speak.
Absolutely.
That's the locomotive, folks, as opposed to the singer, of course, which is a big project again, isn't it?
It is. And I think when I look at the group that has been doing the fundraising for Dame Vera Lynn in particular, they have been fantastic. This has been a long fundraising campaign for them, a lot of years to be able to raise the money to get it to where it is. The fact is, we need both of these engines. Both of them are really important. The Green Knight will basically take us up to Whitby. So that's why that's one of our big priorities this year, because we want to make sure that we can keep going. Dame Vera Lynn, what a story behind it. It's absolutely brilliant. And I would urge people to actually speak to the fundraising group that basically heads that up, because because they've got loads of stories.
And I particularly like your slogan for that, "Wheel Steam Again." I think that's brilliant.
Oh, yes. And credit to them for coming up with that, because you need a good slogan sometimes for these things.
Now, I know one of your new campaigns this year is Sponsor a Seat. So tell us a bit about that and how people can get involved.
Well as obviously looking after raising funds to do the restorations for the locomotives, it's really important that we actually keep investing in maintaining our carriages. So we thought that this would be a really nice way for people to basically be able to contribute towards a fund specifically for that, but also as a way to celebrate. We have the brass plaques that people can have with their name or a loved one's name, and it's got a very specific set of messages on there, like your favourite journey. And it's been really nice, actually, some of the stories have come back from people as to why they've actually got involved with this.
What about more traditional methods of raising money, like legacies? I guess that's a big issue as well for the NYMR.
It is, and the generosity that we've seen over the years has been absolutely fantastic. You know, when we're looking at over £400,000 annually comes from legacies, it's such a gift to us. It's massive. If you compare it to, you know, to restore a locomotive could be anything upwards of £400,000. To have legacy money that kind of comes in, that people can say where that money goes to. They could basically say, well, we'd like this to go to this campaign or just to general running costs. But it's really nice because I think it also just shows the kind of family that's around North Yorkshire Moors Railway and that people really do support it at its core.
How much more difficult has your role as a fundraising supremo become in recent years? Has it become much more difficult since the pandemic to raise funds like this?
I think that all charities find it particularly tough to keep raising funds. I think the great thing for us is that as well as the support that we get from our donors, which, you know, we appreciate every single penny that comes through from it, or even if people are able to gift aid, you know, that little bit extra makes such a difference to us. But we've got great support from our funding bodies as well, and we've seen great amounts come from there, from the Heritage National Lottery. We're a national portfolio organisation with the Arts Council, and you know, some of these things, they make a massive difference to us every year. It gives us stability.
And it really isn't overstating this, is it, to say that without grants like those and without the work that you're doing, if you were just relying on ticket sales, I can't see much of a future. It wouldn't work, would it, really?
I think everything is an absolute balance. And, you know, the more that we can raise that supports our ticketing income, the better. And that's why we're always thinking, what's going to be the next kind of great idea, or what kind of experience can we give people? Because one of the memberships that we have is actually called the Foundation. And this is where basically the funding that people are contributing regularly every month, it's going towards things like new infrastructure projects. And, you know, with that, we want to give these people back an experience. So we organise 4 events a year that people can come on. It could be a tour of the motor power depot. It could be the carriage stables. We're actually up at Gothland this week, hearing our station master basically give us a kind of guided tour and tell us the history of Gothland. So, you know, we're always kind of trying to come up with something new. Sometimes there isn't anything new that you can necessarily come up with as that ingenious, but again, if people want to see, hear things different, we're all ears.
Well, I've got to say, one of the beauties of sitting here doing this is the amazing steam locomotive sound effects in the background. It's perfect, isn't it?
It is, and it's such a charm actually to actually work here, because you get to see it, you get to smell it. That's the other side. You know, it's very sensory, the whole kind of experience of people. So, yeah, it is great when you see them come back through.
So anybody listening to this who's thinking, well, I've been on the North York Moors Railway in the last year or two or whatever, I'd like to contribute somehow, what are the easy ways of doing it? What are the particular projects that people could do, or can they just literally make a donation?
So it's really easy. So on our website, we've got a donate button, and people can basically pick whichever campaign they'd like to get involved in. Obviously, we'd love people to support the Green Knight. This is our main focus for this year, and people can sponsor a stay. They can basically join the Roundtable Club to get updates about, you know, how the kind of fundraising and eventual restoration will be. Head to the website and you'll be able to get all the details of everything that we're doing at the moment.
And are there any future plans you can tell us about at the moment? Anything coming up that you can unveil?
I could tease the fact that we're probably going to have a little auction coming up soon, which could include items from the railway and, you know, money can't buy experiences. We're just pulling all that together at the moment, but we're hoping that this will be coming out in the next kind of couple of months. Again, it's just a different way that hopefully it shows that we're thinking about how we can share what we have here back with people and encourage donations.
And just to round it off then, talking more in the engagement terms, any NYMR members listening to this, you're open to suggestions from them as well, aren't you?
Absolutely. They can contact us direct. Always up for having a coffee with people or a chat on the phone. You know, some of the best ideas will always come from the people out there who've been supporting us for a long time, and no idea is a bad idea yet.
And finally, just to finish off with, you're not actually from a railway background to start with, Kerry, are you? Because I've come across you in a previous life of my own.
Oh, I absolutely love it. I've been really passionate about marketing businesses across Yorkshire for years now. And when I had the opportunity to be in a role where I felt that I was really contributing, giving back and hopefully making a difference, I thought, wow, I've got to do it. Plus, I'm from Darlington. And when you're from Darlington, you grow up with everything about the railway. So it was almost like it was meant to be in some ways.
Kerry Carruthers, Head of Engagement here at the NYMR. Thank you for your time and good luck with the fundraising endeavours in the future.
Thanks, Steve.
When you think of a heritage railway like the NYMR, almost certainly like me, you think of large trains, steam locos, diesel locos, beautiful stations. I wonder, though, if you think so much about the line and the countryside that the trains actually travel through. Well, it's rather an important part of the picture here. And to find out a bit more, I'm talking to Kerry Fieldhouse, who is the Lineside Conservation and Sustainability Manager here at the NYMR. Kerry, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. Let's start at the beginning. How did you get into this line of work in the first place?
I think I spent a lot of my childhood exploring outdoors, and I have spent all of my career and my learning in learning about the ecology of our landscapes, the wildlife and the people in it too. So my jobs always take me to doing ecology conservation work, but also engaging people and communities in that ecology and conservation. I think that's really important.
And with my amazing powers of deduction, you're not from here originally, are you?
I'm not, no. I'm from a little bit further north. I am Scottish. I've lived in Northern England for the last 27 years. I identify strongly with the moors, I have to say.
Okay, so Lineside Conservation and Sustainability Manager. What does that actually mean? What does your job involve here?
The NYMR has 18 miles of track, and as I like to say, 36 miles of line side, because it's both sides of the track. And my job is really to look after that line side, to look after that land holding. And we have some quite broad parts of our line side, so we have quite a bit of land, and it's looking after the wildlife there, it's looking after the habitats, it's looking after the boundaries, so the fences, the dry stone walls, and it's about engaging people with that and telling them about it, because we're part of an incredible landscape where within the North York Moors National Park, we can't get luckier, it's gorgeous, but we're also part of designated sites. So we have 9 miles of SSSI. That means a site of special scientific interest. And we're also part of an SAC, which is a special area of conservation. And that's a European designation because those habitats are rare across Europe, not just in the UK. So we're in a really special landscape. So my job is to keep the line side safe for the railway, and it's, you know, good for operating in, but also for its wildlife and its habitats.
Because you really can't separate the two, can you? You're a fundamental part, as fundamental a part of the countryside as anything else is around here, aren't you?
Absolutely. And in fact, all heritage railways and all railways really have this fantastic corridor. It's a green corridor, an undisturbed green corridor. Very few people are walking in there. There's no dog walking and cats mooching around. You've got this beautiful, fairly undisturbed habitat that runs for miles. And so it's a really brilliant green corridor, a really great wildlife corridor. And that's true for all railways.
Does the special designation of these areas, does that affect in any direct way how the railway operates?
Yeah, absolutely. They're protected sites, so they're protected legally. So there's certain activities that you would not do unless you had special assent, so special consent from Natural England to do. And that's okay. That's about valuing your landscape. It's about stopping and thinking a little bit more carefully about what you're doing and how you're doing it. It doesn't stop our day-to-day, but it does make us think when we have to do larger projects and we make sure that we're putting the right mitigations in place.
So many people working in an office, which is an enclosed room, I guess your office is really 18 miles / 36 miles.
Yes, yes, it is. And it's an incredible office, I have to say. So I am in the office. It's probably 50-50, but I'm really lucky. I think being out there and all of my volunteers and my teams say the same things. You know, being on a heritage railway, watching those trains go past, but being in this stunning landscape with wildlife all around us, it's something else.
And give us some examples of the kind of wildlife, flora and fauna that you are responsible for looking after along the railway route.
So a lot of our line side is fantastic for reptiles, and I do have a little bit of a soft spot for our reptiles. So pretty much wherever you go, you will find common lizards and you'll find slow worms, which look like a snake, but they're actually a legless lizard and they're pretty shy. And we have adders. So there's adders in quite a few locations and they're absolutely beautiful and very rare. They're in decline in the UK. So to have such good populations is really special. We've also got fantastic butterfly populations. We've got grassland and some quite rare plants like the globe flower and fragrant heath orchid, all sorts of different things on the line side. And they attract and provide habitat for some really quite rare dragonflies and butterflies and moths. So we're really very lucky that way. And of course, we have the birds. So there's birds everywhere. There's birds nesting in and on the line side and around us. So you can be sat at Newtondale Halt and then see goshawks fly past and peregrine falcons and buzzards and hear the crossbills and the conifers above you and see the adders down on the track. So really, you're a bit spoiled.
And does your job involve actual interventions on behalf of the nature? I mean, are you creating special areas for the type of creatures you've talked about, or is it more maintaining what's already there?
It's largely maintaining what's already there and being aware of it and keeping on top of it. Our habitats do need to be managed or else we would lose them. And the grassland is largely what the site is designated for, so the special old plants that would have been in the old grazed pastures of this area. So we don't want that coppicing up and becoming full of trees and losing that. But we do have scrub habitat and we do have woodland edge habitat. At the same time, I can add little extra bits. So I can put some reptile refuges in and things like that to give our wildlife a little bit of a boost and a little bit of extra space within those habitats.
And how much of a priority is this for the NYMR? Obviously, fundamentally, it's a business. It has to make money. How much of a priority is looking after the line side as well?
I think it's become a really integral part of who we are and how we talk about it and the pride that we have in our railway and a real sense of belonging within the landscape. Conservation is now one of our charitable objectives. And I think when that happened, that really showed the mood change and that greater understanding of, yeah, who we are within our landscape and with our neighbours and the people that we share this lovely place with.
And how big a team do you have at your disposal, as it were, to make all this happen?
I have got an incredible bunch of volunteers. So I have about 60 volunteers on the books. Some of those are specialist wildlife surveyors. So one of my volunteers was out last night surveying for woodcock, which you do in the evening. That's a bird. Others will be doing fencing and slogging really hard every day to do and mend those fences, which are our legal responsibility as a railway. Others will be doing dry stone walling projects and others will be doing that habitat work. So actually getting down in amongst the vegetation and helping managing hazard trees, the keeping maintaining the grasslands, all of those things, ditches, culverts, all that stuff. And I have wardens too, who do sort of seasonal walkouts to check on the line side and check where things might need a bit of attention, because I can't keep an eye on all 36 miles.
Do you yourself get out to do this kind of thing, or are you more looking after other people doing it?
It's a mix of both, but whatever I can, I'm getting out. I need to be able to see it and see what's happening and see what's changing and prioritise the next task.
And do you actually have a budget for this? Does the railway give you money to make all this happen?
I do have a small budget, and that's absolutely needed. So the fencing's very expensive, wood is very expensive, and we have to make some really clever decisions about things like that. Where do we want to maintain our heritage fencing, and where can we use more newer types of fencing like Clipex, which is metal, but it'll be much longer lasting, much more cost efficient. And so I can use that kind of thing in an area where, for example, you're not going to notice it. It's out of the line of sight, but we use heritage wooden fencing where it's going to be more noticeable because that's part of the aesthetic of the museum, of the railway. But all those things cost money.
So when the railway's looking at big projects like, I don't know, the bridge replacements of recent years and things like that, are you involved in the planning side of that, at least in an advisory capacity, to make sure that nature is represented, shall we say, in those schemes?
Yeah, absolutely. Like anybody, that's part of our normal method of work. So when you're doing a big project like the bridges, I'll be there checking on nesting bird potential, whether there's roosting bats using the bridges, whether there's otters and things underneath the bridges, which quite often there are. And so it's working out how are we going to minimise disturbance to protected species, and if we can, provide additional habitat whilst we're at the job. So let's do some added benefits while we're there.
So we've established your office is 18 miles / 36 on both sides of the tracks. So what would be your favourite spot? If I had to pin you down, what's your favourite spot on the 18 miles of the NYMR?
I'm not very good at favourites because I always feel like I'm leaving out the other one. I think Northdale is really special. So north of Newtondale Holt to Fen Bog is a really special area. It feels remote. And it's got some really special and unique mire, fen, bog habitats and birds. I even saw a sea eagle there once that was on its way down the coast and just bobbed over the hill to have a look and went off. So there's some really incredible wildlife that you can see there. And you can just sit and soak it up in the quiet.
Later on today, we're going to be going down to Levisham, which, of course, is a station literally in the middle of nowhere. I was there a couple of Sundays ago doing a bit of exploration, and I hadn't realised quite how isolated it is. But what an amazing spot for nature there as well.
Levisham's another really special station because it is really quiet and you have to kind of work to get there. So once you're there, you can really enjoy it. You feel like you deserve this space. And we have some beautiful grasslands there. It's a very old kind of pasture grazed, lightly grazed pastures in and around us. It's a very special area. And even in the ditches, there's special, it's full of marigolds in the spring and globe flowers. And it's a little riot of colour. White throat nesting in the willow that's regenerating there. So there's all sorts there. It's a very beautiful area with some quite rare creatures. And it's also where we do work with Forestry England. So it's a special spot.
Well, Kerry Fieldhouse, Lineside Conservation and Sustainability Manager here at the NYMR, thank you for talking to us. And very shortly, we'll join you at Levisham to see you in action, as it were.
You're welcome.
Now, it used to be possible to enjoy a sumptuous meal on many mainline network trains, but a little less so now, with simplified menus and trolley services. However, here on the North Yorkshire Moors Railway, you can enjoy a Pullman dining service aboard beautifully restored carriages, which evoke the old elegance of the 1920s and 30s rail travel. Here to tell us more about it is Chef Paul Harrison. To start us off, a little bit of background about yourself and how you came to be part of this railway family.
So I've worked throughout the North East for most of my career, starting in the Swallow Hotel in Stockton before going to work at Gisborough Hall as the banqueting chef, which is a Rosette Hotel just on the edge of the North Yorkshire Moors towards Middlesbrough. I took a break from chefing but then I saw this advert for here, and basically it gave the opportunity to work without the long hours, working evenings, doing breakfast shifts. So I applied for it and came on board as the assistant chef. And then 2 seasons ago, I took over as head chef. I've always had an interest in trains from being younger. So it gave me the chance to have that interest as well as do my job.
Sort of what type and how many staff are involved in managing the meal service? And this has always fascinated me, the difference in the split between the kitchen area and front of house. How does it work on a train?
So we've got a wide range of staff, from volunteers to seasonal staff. the front of house team, the work of the setting the tables up, making sure all the tables are correct and everything's spot on there. Kitchen wise, we've started this season where we've started bringing in one of the front of house teams and we rotate it so they get the experience of being in the kitchen and understanding the work that goes into producing the meals. Depending on the numbers on board, we up to 12 staff, 2 in the kitchen, 1 in the bar, 2 pot washers, the rest in the front of house team who board the guests, welcome aboard, get them the drinks, settle them down for the journey.
Who's in charge then?
Overall in charge is a gentleman called Tim Burrows. He's ex-REA. He used to be an engineer for the planes. He also used to work on the Battle of Britain Memorial Group for quite a few years. He's overall the train manager, sees everything day to day. I run the kitchen, do my ordering the food, making sure it's all correct.
So what qualifications do kitchen staff actually require?
Most catering companies now look at a food level 2, which is cooking, food preparation. Also, you need a level 2 food hygiene certificate. You have needed the allergens for quite a few years, but it is key to have that allergen and the understanding of the allergens and keeping the customers safe.
How and with whom do you go about determining the type of eating experience and the menus that you actually offer?
We've just planned the Christmas menu, so it's myself and the catering director, Catherine Watson. I'll come with all my ideas, reams of paper, and then we go through it. We talk about what's worked, what hasn't worked, what the customers are asking for. So if we get a customer saying, we want roast dinners on, we take that into consideration. We will be starting next year's menus, the planning, in probably a month's time. Likewise, that'll be the same. We'll sit down, we'll work out what went, what didn't go well, what menus didn't quite fit to what we were planning for certain events. Then we'll go on for there.
Explain to me now what your kitchen contains. I've never been in the working end of a bookie car. And are there any compromises owing to the age of the rolling stock and the confined space you're working in?
So in the kitchen, we have a 6-burner stove and a 4-burner stove at one end. So that gives me 10 gases, a big oven, and then a small oven. We also have a bain-marie where once the veg is cooked, we hot hold it to do service. And then we have a workbench that runs along one side and in part of one of the corners, which we've just spent a great deal of money refurbishing. So it's a nice standard and fit for purpose. Yeah, there is a lot of compromises with the rolling stock. We run on LPG gas bottles, which has to be kept with a very close eye on because there's nothing worse. And it's happened a couple of times where you've run out of gas during the journey. We've actually now on a generator, so we do have a lot more equipment that ran on electricity. Before I started, the bain-marie was run on gas, so it was all as it was back in the time. It was what electricity it did have came from the batteries underneath, so like the lights were powered by the battery and the dynamo and the movement of the carriages.
The train's on the move. I mean, what are the challenges of actually trying to cook on a moving vehicle?
It's knowing how far to fill up pans with liquid, because you do get the sway motion no matter what speed the train's doing, because dining speed is 14 miles an hour. We have had occasions where it slightly goes over that speed, but it's knowing how full to have pans, where to have them situated on the stove. Try not to be cooking as such when you're moving. We mainly serve while we're moving. The majority of the cooking's done before we set off. So it's not a case of we're walking around with red hot pans.
So can you just talk me through a typical day for a chef on a Pullman?
I start at 7:30 on the morning. First jobs I do is fill my water tank up. I then have my safety checks to do, so checking the generators working properly. There's no trips out on there. And then doing my safety checks on the equipment in the kitchen to make sure they're fit for purpose. The emergency gas switch off works properly. So then it's getting all the veg ready, putting them in pans, putting the seasoning in with them, turning on the potatoes for the roast potatoes, because they have to be in the oven for 8:30, because they take from 8:30 till about 11:15. work out it's probably about 25 kilos of potatoes I do a day. Then it's just the rest of general day-to-day getting daft little garnishes, washing lettuce, getting everything ready to start plating up the starters, cook the veg at about 10 o'clock, and that's normally ready for about 11:45, ready to go in the bain-marie to be hot held, ready for service. Making gravies and your stocks, and then the last final check at about 11:45, making sure you've got everything on board, because it's not like you can just run to your store to grab, oh, I forgot that. And I've done that a few times, forgetting stuff.
Depending on what's been served, for practical reasons, is there anything that you have to prepare and then bring on board?
For example, depending on what sort of meat roast we've got on board, if it's a beef, pork or turkey, that has to be cooked the day before, then cool, then be carved, and that's reheated, which we do through the oven with a bit of water in, and we have to get that over 76 degrees to make sure all bacteria is killed off it. Chicken wise, we sort of can cook that on the day, so like if we have a chicken supreme on, we cook that on the day, and that just gets cooked as you would do at home.
What sort of experiences could customers enjoy if they're coming on the Pullman during the season? What sort of menu experiences could you offer them?
From tomorrow we start our summer menu, which has a nest of melon with summer fruits, a slow roast belly pork for starter with a homemade barbecue sauce. Main course wise, we have coq au vin on, we have a fillet of salmon with a avocado salsa. Dessert wise, we've got a toffee cheesecake with cinder toffee and a blueberry frangipane tart. Also, we've got coming up in July, if my memory serves me right, we have our curry train coming on. Now, we used to do these, and the sort of other chefs have not wanted to do them or didn't think it was quite right. I enjoyed making curries. I brought it back this year. We're going to give it a go, see how well it does. Then we have our autumn menu, which is basically runs from end of September to beginning of November. And then we then go on to our Christmas menu, which is the end of November till the beginning of January the next season.
Have you got any strange customer requests?
It's a lot of, like, you'll have roast beef on and they'll say, can I have my medium rare or well done? You'll try to explain to them, well, we don't do it like that. Yes, but I always have it like that, and I would like that. One thing I'd like to finish with, one big thing we have at the moment is allergens. And people that have them not informing us. So they come on board on the day and say, well, I'm allergic to this. And it's, you then have to start running around trying to make sure what they are going to dine with is going to be safe, even though we've done what we can on the booking forms. So if any of you listeners that are planning to come on that have allergens, please just let customer services know so we can make your experience safe.
Well, Paul, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for taking the time, because I know you've got things to do, sort out for tomorrow. Wish you well, really, for all your menus on this coming year. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it, an interesting overview of some of the activities which go on behind the scenes on the North Yorkshire Moors Railway. Our thanks to our podcast guests in this episode, Laura Strangeway, Charlotte Hawes, Kerry Carruthers, Kerry Fieldhouse and Paul Harrison for sharing their stories with us.
However, there is more to come. The episode 2 link is ready for you to click on and enjoy. The first session in episode 2 is with the Director of Mechanical Engineering, Paul Middleton, or Piglet to his friends, as we explore what happens within the railway's motive power depot. We then take a steam-hauled ride from Gromont to Levisham for a second chat, but on the line side with Kerry Fieldhouse, and then back to Gromont to meet Paul Middleton again, but this time in his natural environment in the main motive power shed.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast, and at the end, in just a moment, we'll be letting Alan Dedicote tell you how you can support York Hospital Radio in its ongoing endeavours.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, then please consider making a donation to our charity via Just Giving, justgiving.com/York Hospital Radio. You can also help us by subscribing and writing a review to help spread the word. Thank you for listening to York Hospital Radio Meets.
Your station, York Hospital Radio.